Welcome to the Pinelander Podcast, the official podcast of Pineland, broadcasting to you from an undisclosed location deep inside Pineland, where we discuss faith, family, finances, firearms, freedom, food, and everything else in between with those who believe in living free and living out the values that made this country free. Welcome to the Pinelander Podcast. This is Paul Lefavor, and I'm here with my sidekick, Mike Blackburn. And the Pinelander Podcast is the podcast for America's warriors. Today is Friday, the 26th of April, 2024. And we're talking today about Gaza, Hamas, and Israel's urban warfare with Colonel John Spencer, who is the chair of the Urban Warfare Studies at the Modern War Institute and the host of the Urban Warfare Podcast. Colonel Spencer, welcome, sir.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
Awesome. As you may know, on October 7, 2023, in one of the worst terrorist attacks perpetrated in history, Hamas and several other Palestinian militant groups launched a coordinated series of attacks, we could call raids, attacks, into Gaza Strip, from the Gaza Strip, into southern Israel. They killed some 1,200 Israelis, committed hundreds of acts of wanton barbarism and evil, and then took hundreds of hostages back into Gaza. Who Hamas is and how they were able to do that and what Israel is doing now about it is today's topic for discussion. So, Colonel, welcome back to the podcast. We've had you on two times before. Our first one, we talked about urban warfare and how we're all waking up to the realities of that as the majority of where people live is in urban environments. And then last time we talked about Hostomel and how important that was. And today, this is quite a hot topic. So welcome back and thank you for being on the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me. And I have, man, just on that opening statement, a lot to say about it. If you don't,
absolutely,
yeah, please, yeah, yes, please, get us up to date.
That was the icebreaker.
Yeah, yeah, the icebreaker is interesting because I think it is part of the narrative. And I actually just released, so I have been, I had been to Israel multiple times studying the IDF, studying all the past wars, the Battle of Suez City, Jenin, battles of Jerusalem. It just spent a lot of time on the ground, which gave me a lot of connections. And I just got back a couple weeks ago from deep in Gaza, actually in Khan Yunis, where there's an ongoing, the war is happening on the front line. But it all started on October 7th. And I think an interesting question there is, and I talk about it in my podcast I just released last Friday, is that we call it a terrorist attack. We call it, sometimes some people have tried to call it a raid, things like that. I have now been on the ground to multiple of the sites, met with the IDF, the police, the government, to really understand what happened on October 7th. There is no term that I can use better than invasion. It was an invasion by a army who, yes, they are terrorists because they employ terrorist methodologies. But I think your question is great, is who was Hamas? So Hamas, well, one, what is Gaza, right? So yeah. Hamas is the governing authority, arguably democratically elected in, a terrorist way of democratic vote.
Like Hitler.
Yeah, like Hitler, right? They seized power in 2005 and became the governing authority of an entire territory, which is in de facto a state. So it's not an insurgency, right? Because an insurgency is a force who is resisting a internal force of some type, right. You could say it has, it's not even a guerrilla force. It is an army of a territory who had a full economy. Billions of dollars flowed into Gaza for humanitarian efforts and for development and everything. Hamas had, it has many ministries, as a ministry of health, it has a ministry of agriculture, transportation, education, and a ministry of defense. Hamas was a power with a military. What it launched on October 7th was a division level plus invasion of Israel with the intent to stay. So it wasn't a raid because, raid is a planned withdrawal, just like we would teach. But it launched 4,000 ground forces across the Israel-Gaza border, across 22 penetration sites. It had 4,000 rockets came out of Gaza aimed in trying to hit Israel civilian sites within the first 3 hours. And then these 4,000 ground forces in three waves penetrated the border, took out any military force, and then headed to civilian sites. There are over 20 sites that they attacked. And I talk about in the articles, or in an article and in the podcast, how, I mean, I couldn't, as a ranger, former ranger instructor, and I'm sure you guys from different courses for the special operations community, many of the sites they attacked with its immense precision. They locked them down with snipers, with security forces to ambush any reinforcements coming. And then they methodically went house to house, burning and massacring civilians. But it was an invasion with the intention of going to Tel Aviv and to Jerusalem. That has to do with, okay, it was, if you acknowledge that it wasn't a terrorist group doing a terrorist attack, it was an army of a de facto state, a territory. Israel had left Gaza in 2008, and in 2005, Hamas was elected in 2008. But Israel had left it, secured the borders, as well as Egypt, to Gaza, you know, searched anything going in between the two countries. But for 15 years, Hamas built immense military capability, a special forces unit called the Nukba, which was the first wave of forces that attacked on October 7th, did the invasion and hoped to get farther and basically cause this global uprising, not just of Hezbollah in the north, which opened fire on Israel on October 8th, sent forces across the border, attacked all the border sites as well. But they wanted to keep going. It wasn't that they wanted to pull back. Yes, they expected the counterattack as a kind of a branch or a sequel. I mean, I think they expected Hezbollah to join the fight. They expected the Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, to uprise. They expected a full-scale destruction of the Israel state leading from October 7th.
Yeah, and for our listeners, you can go to the Urban Warfare Project podcast, and Colonel Spencer's latest podcast, the 15th of March, is studying the October 7th terrorist attacks, and there is a ton of detail in that. Yeah. So, yeah, thank you for sketching that out. Yeah, and like you said, their attack was blunted. Something I gleaned from your podcast is their intent was to go all the way to Tel Aviv, to keep going. They had maps. They had and that attack was blunted by the Israeli, you know, best of the best. Is that right?
So in some sense. No, it's right. I just want to, you know, there's so much detail there.
Yeah. Like,
and I think, you know, because we live in this world of 30-second sound bites, the whole world thinks it's like, you know, some people are so ridiculous to think that the civilian killing was incidental because they were trying to hit the military. Like, no. Let me show you how they targeted civilian villages and towns and cities with the sole intent to just massacre as many civilians as they could. And there's lots of details, like you said. But they, they even had books on how to massacre better. Like, right. They had like a ranger handbook of killing. Like, hey, roll your tires into the room. Set a tire on fire. Roll it into the room. It will not only kill them, but it will burn them alive. It'll be great. And literally their manual said this, that they were carrying. So I think that's important to highlight. Yeah.
Yeah. And you also brought this out in your podcast that it seems like they thought that, Hezbollah would join in from the north and it would just create this other uprising in the West Bank. But that, you know, just didn't materialize other than Hezbollah's rockets.
Right. And I mean, there was more. So this is what I actually spent time on the ground in northern Israel this last trip a couple of weeks ago as well. And I think it's been misrepresented too, the amount of attacks that Hezbollah has conducted, not just with rockets, but with direct fire, taking out all the security cameras along the blue line, if you've ever been up there, even sending basically reconnaissance forces across the border, which again, hasn't been talked about as much.
Kind of a probe. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's reason, you know, everybody's going to ask like, why didn't Hezbollah join? And everybody has their ideals. One reason is that the U.S. said, don't do it. And we sent some very heavy firepower and some very strong messages. Like, if you do it, you won't exist anymore.
I get, yeah, so I guess where I was going is I was curious if this was supposed to be a little something bigger that Iran had and planned. Their cronies had planned, yeah. But it just didn't materialize. I mean, it looks correct. Like that's what was happening.
Yeah, 100%. I believe that strongly. I mean, we'll have to wait for, I'm sure, years for actual declassification of evidence of Iran's. I mean, they all the Nukba, all these specially trained forces, just the October 7th attack alone, my assessment as a military guy, like, there's no way that Hamas self, built a professional military education system that allowed them to design such a full-scale invasion of Israel. There's all kinds of evidence of them going to Iran, through Syria, through Lebanon, and getting the Revolutionary Guard, the Quds Force, training and planning and assistance for that operation. But I agree with you that it seems that the master plan of Iran's in some ways didn't materialize, because you can never really estimate that strategic level. What I mean, your greatest ally is, I mean, your greatest strength in any country is your allies. Yeah, the U.S. military is a superpower, so we got a lot of capability. But Iran didn't expect, I don't think, so many people to overwhelmingly come into Israel's defense, at least even in words, but and in clear military capability.
That's what we say to our students often is the enemy has a vote.
And, yeah, absolutely.
They get, the other thing is.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, one thing on the. Oh, so you talk about the what blunted them. Yeah, that's what I forgot. Yeah, so. Look, again, this was a masterfully built plan. They attacked on not just a Saturday, which is a Shabbat, it's a Jewish, every Saturday is a big holiday, but it was also a Jewish holiday. It was the anniversary of the Yom Kippur War. That's right. They were just low, minimal forces, right? Like Christmas for us, you got your staff duty out and everybody's on block leave. They planned for that attack to happen, and they attacked immediately to blind the eyes of those forces, right? The Gaza division headquarters was attacked. Every security force, all the 911 calls overloaded the system. Nobody could see what's going on. They put out their ambushes. So what really blunted the attack was just brave civilians that happened to be armed. A lot of them off-duty police, a lot of them village protectors. Like the Russians didn't plan for. The invasion that we talked about,
right?
Hezbollah and Hamas and Iran didn't plan for the Israelis to fight with such vigor, and it blunted the attack. And there's one instance I think of what you're talking about where these very special guys, the Yamam, which is like their SEAL Team 6, I guess. I don't want to say Delta or anything, but. It's their high level counterterrorism force. We're just heading south. Like all of them had just banded together in a squad, headed south, and they run into this one force of over 20 trucks of Hamas, who had crossed the border and were heading north. And they had this ultimate hot gates of Thermopylae battle, where those few strong men with strong character held off. And lost more for their force than any time in their complete history, holding off that massive force that was headed north.
Yeah, you said that they've lost 10 men, I guess, in the history, and they two before this and eight on that day. It's amazing.
That's right. That's right.
And just what I hear too is how Hamas underrated their enemy. They underrated the Israel's ability to react, and even on that day where. There would be, not a lot going on. A lot of people on leave, not working.
Yeah, I want to say it was at towards the end of Succoth. The Feast of Tabernacles. I want to say it was right at the end of that.
Yeah, just the timing of that too. Just, but the other thing is, when I just talking about that podcast is how they understood. I guess they had good intel on the at least in one sense, they kind of made a wrong turn, it seems.
Yeah.
But other than that, they kind of knew they had it mapped out.
Yeah. I 100% agree with you. They did years of reconnaissance.
Yeah.
That just can't be argued. They did years of reconnaissance on every objective. And I compared it to the 2008 Mumbai attacks, just in the precision to overload the city and the urban structures and everything. But, it, you know, of course, it's way different. It's an invasion. But, yeah, there's that one instance where, you know, in one city, in the biggest city in the south, in Sirot, they went straight to the police station. And they offloaded 20 fighters straight into the police station to take out the security. And then there's another city where they looks like they missed a turn. I'm sure historians will argue later, like, man, maybe they did, maybe they didn't. But, yeah, missed a turn to hit the police, who later come, you know, an hour later and kill all of them as they're running through the city, just massacring civilians.
Yeah, and the in terms of metrics, I believe Hamas and every, you know, everyone who aided them in that, something like 1,000 fighters, KIA, something like that, right?
Yeah, yeah, they lost about 1,000, what we know of, and there were hundreds, I think, of three, what do I say in the pocket, like 300 or 400 that were captured.
Yep.
But yeah, they lost about 1,000. I mean, so they had hours, and this is the problem, and I'm still doing more research. There's multiple more sites I have to go to because, you know, this is the idea, like, where was the police? Where was the basically National Guard? Where was the army? It's like, well, they were fighting their way there as Hamas. You got to give them credit for just the amount of planning that they did to lock down any avenue of approach, both at the tactical level, at the objective, and in the entire region. They sent out ambushes and the gear, man, that they had. And I got to tour some of the gear. It was crazy, the gear that they brought in. The anti-personnel mines, the anti-tank mines, the breaching charges to set up these ambushes so that nobody could come to the rescue of the entire southern Israel without fighting their way there.
Wow. Yeah, and they, from their launching off point, now, if I can shift gears here, in your article on Gaza's underground, you talk about Hamas's entire political military strategy rests on its tunnels. This came out 18th of January. And what I found is, you know, I think we're discovering, I discovered anyway, how extensive these tunnels really are. I mean, just amazing amount of concrete and metal and,
sophisticated.
Digging. Yeah, it's
electronics,
crazy.
Yeah.
Could you just sketch out, like, what that really looks like? Just kind of a...
Yeah. It's hard to give people an actual appreciation of it by just giving you the numbers, right? And I even wrote that article before going myself into Gaza, into a Hamas tunnel that was massive, like a multi-million-dollar invasion tunnel that they found.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was 400 meters from one of the crossing points, but it was actually like 100 meters from the border between Gaza and Israel. It went 2 miles. It went 4 kilometers back into Gaza. And if you know how short the distance is, but you could drive trucks through it. It really reminded me of the tunnel I've been in South Korea, the North Korean invasion tunnel number 3. That scale was huge.
Yeah, I've been down
it had there. You've been that one. It's amazing. But this one was better. It had a steel liner towards the top of it. It had all reinforced concrete, had air ventilation, power, phone, like cables. I don't even know what is that? Like Ethernet? Had crazy capabilities.
Kind of like the Viet Cong that
on
steroids.
On steroids. I mean, so by the numbers, even they trump, you know, even the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese tunnels, right? So even in this short amount of space, so if you know what Gaza is, it's a small territory, like 25 miles long, 7 miles wide at its greatest point. They built, and some people said it wasn't possible because in that article I talk about before the war, and I'd been in Hamas tunnels and Hezbollah tunnels before the war, but the greater community of people, to include Israel, estimated that there were probably about 200 miles of tunnels in Gaza, ranging from 15 feet to 300 feet underground. And if you know, you probably do. I mean, at 300 feet, there's pretty much no military munition that can reach you at 300 feet down, right? Even the Moab that we dropped on Afghanistan, right? The biggest
mother of all bombs,
That's right. The biggest munition since the dropping of the nuclear weapon was meant to get at a tunnel complex, but it wasn't at that depth, right? At that depth, it's pretty much untouchable. Well, the problem is that the estimates were wrong. And that they are discovering, we won't know what the total number, but the estimate now is over 300 miles. And at greater depths and at greater detail. I mean, So this is my research going into, they're fighting week-long battles in northern Gaza before they even get to the enemy, because each battalion has its own battalion tunnel with company tunnels. I heard an amazing quote, which I think is actually true. It isn't that Hamas, like I say in the article, built all their tunnels underneath all the civilian areas.
Right.
There is that, and they've spent billions of dollars doing that, but they also built stuff on top of their tunnels. So it's almost like chicken versus the egg, is that their entire – so just imagine if there was a – you know, it's – they think North Korea is like this, and China has thousands of miles as well, but where you take so vast resources of your economy and invest it only in developing tunnels, which are only for – military purposes, right? Because you could argue, like, you know, subway tunnels, and like when I went to the Battle of Kyiv, millions of civilians sought refuge in the tunnels. Well, in Gaza, the civilians aren't allowed in the tunnels. It's only for military purposes, only for Hamas, which is, again, another, this is that political strategy that I talked about. Yes, Hamas attacked. Yes, Hamas had intentions of much greater full destruction of Israel on October 7th, 8th, and on. But they had a plan as well. They built their entire military strategy for over 15 years to be able to survive IDF attacks, especially from the air. And if they entered the ground, to make the IDF pay for every inch, but not with the intent of killing the military, but for the world to stop the IDF, which is actually historical. It's happened in almost every war that Israel has fought that they've never started in defense of their country. Somebody will step in, usually the United States being the biggest pressure, like the Yom Kippur War, say, look, I know you have the right to defend yourself, and I know they attacked you with multiple armies, but you need to stop. Yeah. That's the political strategy in which Hamas built, knowing that, and building their – they actually are the first people that I've seen in history of war using not human shields, right? That's not new, right? All the terrorists that we've all faced – that's like kind of operator's modem, right? Is to use human shields so you can't attack them. Hamas is the first I've ever seen using human sacrifice, as in their political strategy rests on getting as many of their civilians, not your civilians, their civilians, killed so that the international condemnation will make the IDF stop and they achieve their strategic goal, which is of the war. So their strategy for the overall, their existence is to destroy Israel, but their strategy for the world is just to survive it. And this is, you know, using the tunnels, which makes it go very slowly, using the tunnels, the time, and human sacrifice to get the world to force the IDF to stop, Hamas survive. So it's crazy.
Well, you bring up something interesting, somebody commented on some weeks ago, and I thought I found it interesting, which was they were talking about the civilian to combatant fatality ratio.
Yeah.
And what they were talking about, and I didn't know this, but they were talking about the fact that the IDF has done an exceptional job at really paying attention to that. The number that I saw was 3 to 10. As compared to, let's say, when Israel went into Lebanon in 1982, you know, there was 5 civilians killed for every 1 combatant. So the article was basically saying that the IDF was very much aware of the strategy of Hamas and has really bent over backwards trying to keep the civilian death toll to a minimum and going at to their own suffering. So they can accomplish that mission.
Yeah, Colonel, those are your words when you were interviewed on Fox, I believe, how that Israel is taking unprecedented steps to protect the citizens. I mean, how can you tell us their strategy and how they're doing that?
And is that ratio correct that we heard that basic 3 to 10, or is it something different?
No, it's 1 to 2 or 1 to 1.
Okay.
And the problem is that, so there's so many things that have happened in this war, as you know, as we are kind of students of the profession, that have never been done before, right? One of the things that's been done is that the world listens to a terrorist number of how many civilians are killed in a combat area. I've never seen that, right? Well, Hamas, the only numbers of civilian casualties is coming from the Gaza Health Ministry, which I just told you that Hamas was a de facto state with multiple ministries, and you didn't work in those ministries unless Hamas let you, and many of those people actually were involved in the October 7th attack. So the idea that the Gaza Health Ministry's number of civilian casualties could be used then to make that calculation is not true, right? I've never studied an urban battle to include our own where they knew in the middle of the battle. That would be like stopping, you know, the Marines in the Second Battle of Fallujah and saying, okay, Al-Qaeda is saying that you killed 100 today. Okay, we're going to take that number. It's crazy. It just doesn't happen. After the battle, people will have an estimate. There is something about this, you know, the First Battle of Fallujah, there was – the world was listening to the enemy and the media saying that there was an inordinate number of civilian casualties, and we stopped. But, again, I wrote two articles that I recommend listeners read. One is that Israel has taken more steps to prevent civilian harm than any military in the history of war. Yeah. And two, that there is no comparison – and I really wish people would stop doing it. There is no comparison to the war against Hamas in Gaza to anything that's happened in the last 80 years or 70 years. I can take you back to World War II and give you one example. And I give this in the article, and you probably heard me say this before, is the 1945 Battle of Manila.
Right.
And we had 3,000 prisoners of war and civilians, men, women, and children, that were American and British and a couple other countries being held in Manila by the Japanese. And and Manila was also this giant city of a million people. MacArthur loved it. He served there. His father served there. But we wanted to liberate the city from the Japanese. And more importantly, we wanted our prisoners of war and civilian hostages back. So MacArthur famously says, go to Manila, go to Santa Maria, liberate our people. So we launched a two-division attack, 37,000. They had 17,000 Navy forces who had prepared Manila for defense. And it took 2 weeks, but we liberated our people, and 100,000 civilians were killed. That's the only comparison in modern history. But what's not there? The Japanese did have tunnels there. They had the sewer system, and they built tunnels. They didn't have rockets emanating out of Manila hitting Los Angeles, let's say. There's so many things that aren't there, but that's the only historical example. It's not any counterterrorism or counterinsurgency operation. That's not what's going on. This is war against a ruling authority with a military who is defending enemy territory, holding civilians, launching rockets. So on the numbers of civilian casualties, yes, I went there twice now to look at the steps that they have taken to prevent civilian harm, like giving notice, like evacuating cities, which has become a common thing in counterinsurgency, counterterrorism operations, like the battles against ISIS. Eventually, at first we tried to basically convince ISIS just to leave cities. Eventually, President Trump gave the mission to annihilate cities, or not to annihilate ISIS. So we surrounded Raqqa and Mosul, and then our purpose was to destroy ISIS. But this civilian to combatant ratio, yes, the numbers, if you actually took the numbers, even if you took Hamas's numbers of civilian casualties, the fact that it has zero combatants in it, and this is crazy, I tell you just as a military guy, that the world, to include some very important politicians, just keep running with Hamas-provided numbers without, and not saying that in that number there are some Hamas combatant deaths. Mm-hmm. It's crazy.
Right.
I've never seen a war where there's just this giant number, and nobody will acknowledge that that number includes the enemy that the attacking force is killing. So if you took out any reasonable number of combatants from that number, you would get to a 1-to-2, 1-to-1 ratio. But here's the big problem in an article I have coming out hopefully today. Who knows? So it'll probably be out before the podcast. That's not the way war works, right?
Yeah.
So if you can, what was the... So there were 17,000 Japanese in Manila, and there were 100,000 civilians killed. What's that ratio? The problem is that's not the way war works. That's not the way the law of war works. The law of war requires you, one, on a bigger scale, to use proportional force to remove the threat. Like if it's a self-defense war like Israel is, what is the force necessary to remove the threat, as in destroy Hamas? And then when you're doing attacks, to make proportionality assessments on use the force to attack the military target, only attack the military targets, use the force necessary to achieve that goal, and then make a collateral damage assessment based on the value of the military target you're attacking. So you have to calculate, like, okay, what is the target? What is its value? Like, is it a deep buried tunnel with a military leader in it? Of what level? And then make an estimate of what the known civilian casualties will be. If the world gets to a point where we say, look, like, I know you have the right to fight this war. Yes, send your divisions. But if you get to a 1-to-3 civilian to combatant ratio, despite all your efforts, and this is what the IDF have done that nobody's ever done. Not only did they surround cities and empty them of 80-90% of the civilian population, they put hundreds of soldiers on phones and call direct into civilians. We've never done that. They sent 7 million texts. They dropped just this many million flyers. They have drones with speakers that will fly into an area and broadcast, please leave this area. It is a combat area. Now they gave out their maps, right, their GRGs, the entire civilian population and the enemy. And then they use the GRG, the map, to determine what the civilian population is, and they can't go in those areas until they evacuate them to a certain percentage. And then they do tactical pauses every day. So they literally telegraph every move to the civilians and the combatant, the enemy, Hamas. So in the pursuit of bringing that number down to some, what, acceptable number in the world's view, it's really problematic, in my opinion.
Yeah, it seems that our modern sensibilities and the media and other forces are hamstringing Israel from, you know, at least from the way we would do things in the Battle of Manila, arguably. But they are, in fact, taking unprecedented steps. I mean, those are unprecedented steps. I'm not a historian like you, but I can't find any precedents in history that shows something like they're doing. I don't know if
We would probably
that is zero.
Yeah, we would probably relieve our commanders for even suggesting such. But
right. So on that, I want to write this. I don't know if it'll come out before this episode, but what would America do?
Yeah.
Right. It's a great question. Right. This isn't World War II. Right. There actually were Geneva Conventions after World War II that said things like, we will not bomb cities just to bomb cities. Like, we won't target trying to convince the enemy that, look, you know, we will only target military targets, right? Like, even the firebombing of Tokyo, where we killed, you know, 180,000 in a single night, more than both bombs and of the nuclear bombs dropped on Japan. And then we killed over 300,000 in just the firebombing of Tokyo, trying to convince the Japanese to surrender. Like, the post-World War II, we said we wouldn't do it again. But I agree with you that there is a myth out there, and I'm sorry, it's some of it's because of the vampire fallacy of special forces, that there's another way. Mm-hmm. Like, really? Like, I'm telling you, from studying this for over a decade and traveling the world, that if you have an enemy-held city where the enemy is defending, in especially if they have subterranean, where they're using human shields and human sacrifice, there's a different way. This is the way that we would do it, which is more overwhelming force, more speed, more surprise,
that's right,
in order to bring the battle to an end faster. So I want to answer the question is, what would America do? What would we do if, you know, let's say, you know, some army in Mexico invaded Southern America, launched, you know, tens of thousands of rockets, took tens of thousands of civilians, massacred tens of thousands of men, women, and children. I guarantee you we would respond with immediate, overwhelming force, to include a intense bombing campaign so that every rocket raining down. Again, this is what people don't even talk about in Gaza. There have been 12,000 rockets that have come out of Gaza. 10% of those have killed some of those civilians in those numbers, because 10% of Hamas rockets have landed inside of Gaza. Nobody talks about the fact that 12,000 rockets, now it's, I think it's 13 or 14, have emanated out of Gaza since October 7th, aimed at Israel civilian sites. Like, if that was happening to us, you guarantee we'd stack every strategic bomber that we have on a 24-hour bombing campaign until those rockets stop.
Yeah. You know, the you brought this out in your article, too, Gaza's Underground, that, you know, Hamas's strategy. And I see the baked-in evil genius of Hamas's strategy is to shield its C2 nodes with no-shoot facilities. So if I'm right, you know, like under schools and hospitals and they probably have underground, you know, bigger facilities to house their soldiers and their headquarters. And knowing so when Israel is, you know, rightly targeting infrastructure of Hamas, they're avoiding these hospitals and other no-shoot areas. And that's probably, I don't know if that's right.
Yes. Okay. No, 100%. And as a military guy, you would understand, like we go into, like I went to the IDF, I'm looking at their GRG. Of course, they have every sensitive site marked, like every hospital, every school, every UN facility, everything marked as a no-fire area in which you can't even if you're taking fire from that area, you can't return fire without literally the chief of staff. I mean, because the proximity to like their Pentagon is so they can't even respond to the operation without the prime minister or the chief of staff of the military's authority. But again, this is the first in that strategy. There's other people who have tunnels. Absolutely. China has thousands of, you know, I don't want to say thousands. They have a lot of tunnels. North Korea has a lot of tunnels for military purposes. Nobody's ever purposely built all of their tunnels under their own civilians with the intent to be that you can't touch me unless you come through my civilians or through my civilian infrastructure. That's unique in war, I'm telling you. Yeah, ISIS built some, you know, for the 2 years they were allowed to hold Mosul. Again, not what we would do. You think we would let, you know, Los Angeles be taken by an enemy force and for 2 years just wait to liberate it? No. Yeah. Again, that's a different context. But the fact that, like the Jabalia strike, right? So there was a strike early in the war where in the Jabalia, northern Gaza, there's an area called Jabalia, which is called a refugee camp. But if you actually know, if you've ever been to Israel, you know that within Palestinian territory, there's a designation of refugee camp where it's a UN designation, but it's actually buildings, right? You know, like 8-story concrete reinforced buildings, like there's no tents or anything. But there was an enemy in a very deep buried tunnel in that camp. So they struck it with a very big bomb to get to the commander in that tunnel who had built the tunnel underneath a civilian building. So it took a lot of, you know, a 2,000-pound bomb, basically, to get to it, to collapse it on top of him. But this also gets you to, and I think important for your listeners, is about, I've been teaching urban warfare for a long time, too, right? I have the division-level course out in California for division and brigade staffs. We talk about everything from how do you use special operation forces to what would you do if you knew there were tunnels in an environment, right? One, I'm trying to convince people that the tunnels are like the main means for the Hamas strategy, right? They just want to buy time, right? So they built them for protective reasons. They also use them for offensively, like that they pop up, you know, and then they attach a bomb to a tank that has an active protection system, and they had to combat that. But what would a military, and this is what we try to teach in our course, okay, you know there are hundreds of miles of tunnels in that operating environment. What are you going to do about it? Like planning wise. And this is a question that I've found even on my last visit, which has really started to blow my mind. Like Israel has the only large scale tunnel trained, manned and equipped force. It's their special operations engineers called the Yahalom. And it's a massive, it's over a brigade, basically a size. Like we don't have one of those. And I knew they were prepared, but they also have a culture of like we do, like we'll go in a tunnel if we have to, but if we don't have to, don't do it. Right. Now they're at a point in the war, which I think there's a lot of learning to be had, where they had a Navy SEAL, a former Navy SEAL, their version of Navy SEALs, who's now a division commander, a maneuver commander, which is, again, we don't do that, who said, like, I don't like this, the fact that they had the element of the underground. So he started sending special operation forces, a group of them, into the tunnels, not to clear them like we do, but to use them as maneuver corridors to maneuver on the enemy. Wow. It's insane what he's been able to do, but it's the second part to that tunnel article, which I'm going to write how they basically answered that question. They're like, what do you do? Well, you view it as a negative. And now they've turned the tide to where they've taken that away from them. And this is where IDF haven't gotten credit in the war. Mm-hmm. Like we were just talking about, I can tell you all the things they've done to prevent civilian harm that no military, to include us, have ever done, period. We've never telegraphed we never handed out our maps. But they took Hamas's strategy of causing civilian death away from them. Yes, you'll never bring it down to zero. And I think this is it will never be zero. It never has been. It never will be. You limit civilian casualties as much as feasibly possible. That's actually the law of war wording, is feasibly possible. Mm. And you take constant care to not, you know, so that they have done that. And they've taken away Hamas's ability to get civilian casualties killed. And now I've found out they've taken away Hamas's ability to rely on the tunnels to buy time. So they've entered the tunnels and used them as maneuver corridors on the enemy. So if I was Hamas, I'd be, you know, scared shitless right now.
Yeah, no doubt. And now that everyone's packing down to Rafah, I have two questions for you, Colonel. One is, what's the end game at this point for Hamas? I mean, if in fact, I don't know if they thought this far, you know, in the future, you know, if they can bide time, and they would have these other elements of Iran's, you know, network, you know, initiate their attacks or have enough international consent, dissent against what Israel's doing to, I mean, what would that look like, their end game?
Yeah, no, I think it's so unique, I think, is that it's not clear a lot of times where we're fighting, right? Even the global war on terrorism, like, what's the end game here?
Yeah.
One is to prevent another 9/11, right? That's a pretty clear end game. But, you know, there's questions on what that looks like around the world. And people have, you know, it's changed. But in the war against Hamas, Hamas told the world multiple times, and to include since October 7th, what their end game is: destruction of Israel and the death of all Jews, period. That's their grand strategy. Their end game for this war, and you have to ask, what is the Iran end game? Mm-hmm. Iran wants complete instability in the Middle East. It wants the use of proxy warfare to be effective. So that, you know, we don't have time to talk about the Houthis and the Hezbollah and the Shia militias of Iraq. This is a test of Iran's end game. But the end game for Hamas in Gaza is survival, period. If their senior leadership, it doesn't even have to, they could sacrifice, you know, they had a military of over 30,000 forces and coherent battalions. If you count in all the kind of secondary forces, it's way more than 30,000. But they could sacrifice 95% of them. And as long as the senior leadership survives, they have achieved a great victory for terrorist resistance of any part of the world. So if they escape Gaza and survive, if they negotiate some type of deal where they get sanctuary somewhere else, they have achieved victory, in my opinion, because they'll be able to, the whole world, every other force that just names themselves something different, whether you name yourself Lion's Den or Palestinian Jihad, they'll be able to say, like, well, that worked. Israel was brought to their knees.
Yeah, almost like, it's almost like at this point, maybe, and it's like, doesn't make any sense to us, it's insane, but like a de facto nation of martyrs. If they're willing to sacrifice their own people.
And that's their own wording, brother. That's it. They say that. They said, we need the martyrs of our people.
Yeah.
We are fine being a martyrs, but again, the human sacrifices, like, I'm fine. You know, you and I have both run into evil around the world, to include those suicidal that want to die for their cause, and I'll help you with that.
Yeah.
But not once you say, I want the martyr of all my civilians, whether they want to be martyrs or not, in order to achieve my ultimate goal. And again, this is, if they survive, they have won, in my opinion, period. And we'll see. So this is like, I know you're a student of terrorism as well. I mean, like the rampant hijacking of planes during the 1970s, rampant, and cruise liners and everything by terrorists, because it was effective, right? They got paid, they got political power, right?
This, stylistic back then, yeah.
Yeah. So if October 7th, if that leads to a victory for just five senior Hamas members, to include the political leadership in Qatar,
they have seen,
it's a presidency, and you'll see it repeated, right?
Yeah.
So you'll see October 7th, this Iran strategy of building massive proxy forces who can conduct these invasions, cause all this instability, get the whole world on the terrorist side, which is insane.
Hey,
You'll see it happen more.
Now, since you said that, my second question is, now that I think that they assume that Israel would be bogged down in a morass of coin. Yes. But I don't think they understood how that Israel would, they couldn't have seen how Israel was undertaking that, how they're undertaking a strategy of coin. And they're, even though they're hamstrung in some sense, they're still making stuff happen. And they're painstakingly, you know, they care about civilian casualties. So my question is, now that things are kind of stacking up and people are just like cordwood and Rafah, what does that look like? How do they, what's the end game for Israel? How does Israel separate Hamas from the population in light of history? How does this end?
Yeah, I think my personal opinion, based on my decade of research, is that Israel can finish the destruction of Hamas very similarly to the way they have already done it. Mm. I was on the ground in Khan Yunis with that division commander, that Navy SEAL, walking me around in the battle, and showing me this insane approach to
street by street,
but also different ways to surprise Hamas and take that strategy of getting civilians killed away. Multiple brigade attacks in a single very small area to surround an area and then evacuate it, versus just letting them leave with the civilians, right? So surround an area, no fire, no shots fired. They could absolutely, this is again where everybody wants to use the numbers of southern Gaza, because, you know, Rafah City is not Rafah's refugee camp, it's not the Al-Muassi, wants to use the high number of civilians in an area to say it's not possible, right? You can't do it without killing too many civilians. Like, what? Actually, I just showed you literally 2 weeks ago, in a city of 800,000, I can do it with historically low civilian casualties and taking away Hamas's goal. So for me, it's very clear, but all war is politics by other means.
Yeah. And then with absolutely now, how does that shake out with, you know, our coin strategy, arguably, not always happens, but clear, hold, build. It looks like Israel's doing that. They're clearing the areas. They're holding it. I'm sure, I mean, there's going to be, a kilometer wide no man's zone. How does that work?
So
I guess to correlate our strategy with the one they're doing, I guess.
No, I think, so it's so hard, right? This is what people have tried to do. I'm insistent on, Hamas is not an insurgency. There is no counterinsurgency going on in Gaza yet.
Right.
Even in northern Gaza, where they did very effectively cleared urban terrain of the enemy forces, as in the enemy coherent battalion companies, even platoon level forces, cleared their tunnels. Of course, as they don't have the manpower. So you know what this is the thing with counterinsurgency, right? One, we're not there. Like, nothing in this war has yet to be counterinsurgency, because Hamas is still the governing power of Gaza. It's still the military force. We're not fighting an insurgency for Gaza, you know, for Hamas against Hamas. I mean, that's ridiculous. That's crazy, right?
Yeah.
Yes, the clear hold build methodology in counterinsurgency has been tried and true, shown to be effective. But, and this gets to our challenge, even as Americans in Iraq for, you know, almost 10 years, is that the number of security forces in which are needed to hold an area, so clear hold build, building, but to even hold an area is one security force for 50 population, right? So we got up to like 600,000 in Iraq because we counted the Iraqi army, the Iraqi police, the Sons of Iraq, you know, the local gang leaders that I paid to stand guard. That is maybe, this is the day after question. How to finish Hamas off is very clear for me, and it can be done with low civilian casualty. How to prevent Hamas from resurging and how to go back and mop up is a great question, because who is the governing authority? Even in Afghanistan and Iraq, there was somebody else we were fighting the counterinsurgency for, right? So
that's an important distinction. Yeah,
local police. Like, even in northern Gaza, like, who are the police maintaining security? Well, I mean, there isn't any yet.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, the Arab nation. This is the point. Like, everybody says that Gaza was a, you know, was surrounded by Israel. Like, well, it has a border with Egypt. Did you forget about that? I mean, this, the counterinsurgency phase, which I agree with you, clear, hold, build, and somebody will have to build, absolutely, like we did, right? Build the security forces back up and rebuild from the destruction. You got a lot of UXO removal, dead body removal, all those things that I've given lectures about as well. But who is that? Is the Arab nations, let's say Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, like all the, and who else? It's not just an Israel problem. What Gaza has been able to create within itself, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
No, I mean, many of Israel's neighbors, Jordan and Egypt in particular, are not fond of the Arabs living in Gaza. They've had a long history of problems, and that's probably one of the reasons why Jordan...
I 100% agree with you. And there's reasons for that, right? We didn't even talk about... This is the only war I've ever seen where they're the... Not just removing civilians, but the civilians have, they can't leave the greater combat area, right? So because Egypt said not a single, you know, in lockdown their borders, they let you know, patients and people from other countries and stuff through, but they locked down their borders. Like that's unique. And Israel has still found a way to target Hamas to fight the fact that basically refugees is, can't be created. I mean, there were like 5 million people who initially evacuated Ukraine when Russia illegally invaded. In Syrian war, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of refugees fled to other countries. But in this case, Egypt says, you know, no, period. Like, okay, and Israel still found a way.
So at some point, you know, you have to win the hearts and minds. And that's really where the hard work comes in. Yep. And I know the media loves to, you know, paint this picture of this, you know, sort of the innocent civilian in Gaza, and then of course the Hamas combatants. Since you've been there, and you know, Paul and I have both been into that region, we're reasonably familiar with it. But what would you say the support level is amongst the Arabs in Gaza for Hamas?
Yeah, I mean,
how much interconnectability is there?
Yeah, it's a lot. And I think this is where, so in war, I try to stick to a common definition. They're either combatants or non-combatants. So innocent civilian, to me, you mean non-combatants. You mean people who are not partaking in the hostilities. And you can partake in the hostilities of a war without even holding a weapon. Through support, through observation, through hindrance. I don't know the true level, but you know, there are polls that show like 80%, you know, even in the Judea and Samaria West Bank, 80-90% support for Hamas, even after October 7th. Wow. So the connections of support in Gaza and even in the West Bank, I don't know if you want to believe the polls, it's not kind of my world. On the ground, it's, you know, as a military guy, and it would be really hard for me as, if I was a commander, like, look, there's combatants or non-combatants. Of course, we'll take every step possible to protect civilians and to get civilians out of harm's way. But this is the thing, like, also, the enemy is not wearing military clothing, right? Yeah. So that ability to say, well, that's a civilian supporting Hamas, or that's a Hamas. That's a member of the enemy military's army, right? It isn't a terrorist force. I really wish I wish we just wouldn't. I wish that Hamas didn't exist, but it is a terrorist army.
Yeah, no, I think you did a great job of really undoing the narrative, which is, you know, these aren't terrorists. This is a state.
Yeah.
Yeah. De facto state.
Yeah.
Right. Because the state has, you know, that's a whole bucket of, you know, of controversy, right? This is the idea of a two-state solution. Again, politics I don't get into. Like, what do you mean? Like, geographically, what do you mean?
Yeah.
Well, and defined borders, a governing authority. Like, well, if the governing authority of that other state has in their charter the destruction of its neighbor, and that's kind of a big deal. And it's doing everything, billions of dollars to attack its neighbor. And then there's a problem with that, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I appreciate that deep dive in the situation that's unfolding over there, Colonel. And as an expert in urban warfare, as you're applying your knowledge to the situation and bringing it out for us today. I just had one last question. I have, I'm also a student of war like you, and Clausewitz, he once wrote, "In war, many roads lead to success, and they do not all involve the opponent's outright defeat." And I think, in my mind at least, that's what the strategy of Israel at this point is. They're not looking to, you know, completely annihilate the enemy, and I think they would be happy for the fighting elements of Hamas to lay down their arms and surrender. So it doesn't, in other words, victory doesn't involve everyone being massacred.
100%.
Yeah.
And this is the ideal. Yeah. Even Southern Gaza operation, who knows by the time this your podcast releases, that not necessary. No. I agree with you. If Hamas was to give up every one of the over 100 hostages, which many of them are dead bodies,
yeah,
if they would surrender, lay down their arms, and surrender anybody involved in the October 7th invasion massacre, yeah, and agreed to have the terrain, you know, basically turn. So this is the other issue, which determines whether a commando raids would work. We didn't talk about this, about a permissive environment.
Yeah.
So yes, if Hamas surrendered and turned the areas which have not been searched, right? Because we didn't talk about the fact that in these tunnels were things that nobody, to include the Israelis, knew was there. Massive weapons manufacturing plants, not like particles, but like plants of chemicals, machine lathes, stuff that nobody knew was and it's 100 feet underground, a massive plant. You have to search and take that away from whatever, so that other people just don't fall in on it. So yeah, the war could end tomorrow if they surrendered, released the hostages, turned the other areas into permissive environments. Massive, like a historic humanitarian aid operation that has already been happening, will continue rebuilding everything. I agree with you, but I think Clausewitz would look at the war in Israel a little differently. He would also look at it as a war, since Hezbollah is attacking with a massive military, again, it's a military force in the north, that the path to victory has to address all the threats to your survival.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're all going to be waiting with bated breath to see how this unfolds. But I do believe, as you said, the way Israel is prosecuting this war is it's going to end in success.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a whole bunch of TTPs come out of this that are going to be very useful in the future.
A lot of stuff to learn. But, Colonel, thank you. I'll give you the last word.
I think, you know, especially for our military audiences, I think there is a lot to learn here. Again, is we have sometimes a dogmatic way of thinking about the war tactics, techniques, and procedure. And the idea of historically, the Yom Kippur War, Six-Day War, and now the war against Hamas have shown me as a military student that your thinking is too rigid. Like, literally, think about what the enemy is trying to do and take that away from them. Because the greatest strategy, of course, is to take the enemy's strategy away from them.
Well said. That is absolutely true. Yeah, fight the enemy's plan, not their. Absolutely. And if you like what you heard today, Colonel John Spencer is the chair of the Urban Warfare Studies at the Modern War Institute at West Point. He also is the host of Urban Warfare Podcast. There's a ton of awesome reads in there, podcasts. I've listened to a bunch of those getting ready for today. As an expert in urban warfare, he applies that knowledge to what's going on today. So, Colonel, thank you for showing up today on the podcast. It was an honor to have you back.
Absolutely.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, brothers. Appreciate it.
All right. Bye.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Pinelander Podcast. If you enjoy our unique content, please consider supporting our sponsors. Soft News provides special operations news from around the world. It's where Paul and I go to keep abreast of what's going on within the SOF community. Check them out at SOF.news. American Partisan. It's the vanguard movement of Western civilization. Be sure to check them out at AmericanPartisan.org. And, of course, Blacksmith Publishing. We've been serving the warrior class since 2013. They have a great titles written for warriors, by warriors. If you're looking for excellent reference material or just want to enjoy a great novel, be sure to check out the bookstore. Or if you enjoy hanging out with warriors, come spend some time with us in the G-Base over at the Pinelander Podcast. All that's at blacksmithpublishing.com. Until our next meeting, stay mentally and tactically smart, physically and spiritually strong, and socially astute. To each other, we pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. May God continue to bless Pineland.